All right, church, grab your Bibles. We are almost done here with Mark. We are in the Gospel of Mark, which is in the New Testament. We're going to be starting in chapter 14, verse 42. And we're going to cover a lot of ground. We've been slowing down in the past weeks. We're going to pick up a little bit here, but we only have three times together left in this gospel. The theme of it has been this: follow the servant. And you've seen the imagery now for a number of months, that the idea that the world and people will walk in a certain direction, most often away from Jesus. Yet we're called to do something different. We're called to walk differently. We're called to turn the other direction from that which the world, the quote-unquote religious, the secular, the way that they walk, and we're called to follow the servant the other way. And he's a suffering servant. The theme verse talks about that in Mark, and you're going to begin to see, carried on in what was started last week, this suffering really play itself out. I mean, these are marked moments for the people we're going to see in this text. And the intensity has never been greater for them, for disciples, for the religious leaders, for the secular government officials, for criminals. This is a marked moment for them. You'll remember last week, PJ took us to the garden, didn't he? Gethsemane, where Jesus just poured out his soul, poured out his heart, and that the human side of Jesus, the God side of Jesus, was set and knew from the very beginning what he had to do, but the human side wrestled and toiled and pleaded to the Lord to take this thing away. But at the end of the day, he set aside those feelings to say, not my will, but yours. And that's where we are now at the end of this garden experience, and it's going to be a marked moment that's really going to be a make or break moment. You ever had those moments in life? They don't come around very often, and when they do, you remember them forever. And they make or break the future. They don't define you ultimately, but they make or break the trajectory of where you're going. I had one of those when I was a sophomore in high school. I've had many of them in my life, but I had one of those make or break moments as a sophomore in high school. I went to my first party. And I was a kid who got along with everybody. I could hang with the academia kids. I could hang with the jocks. I could have fun with the drama kids. I could sit with whoever and be kind of somebody who's eclectic and floats around. But I remember going to this party. And I remember showing up at this guy's house in Tulsa, Oklahoma. His parents were out of town, of course, right? And kids are there, and they had alcohol. And I grew up with a dad who I was known as beer boy. All he had to do was say beer, and I'd have to go get it, right, and bring it to him. And he just drank often. So I grew up in a home where that was present. And so I always saw what it did to my dad and thought, I'm never going to be that way. But I remember going to this party. And I remember going, and there was this island there. And I, in my head, I can still remember the imagery crystal clear that I'm looking around and I'm seeing all these different kinds of liquor and beer, cheap beer, and different things. And I'm thinking, is this what you want? Is this how you're going to define the next few years of your high school, going with this crowd for this style of life? Or are you going to do something different? I remember, like, it was pressing upon me. It's like the Lord had me right there and just, it was pressing me. I was a Christian and I just had this decision to make. And looking back, I'm grateful for the grace of God that said, call your mom. Call your mom and have her come get you. This is not who you're going to be. And I made a decision to walk out of that house, call my mom, have her come get me. And I chose in that make or break moment a different path. Unfortunately, you're going to see here, people, his very disciples, all the people around Jesus are not going to make the right choice. They're not going to make the right choice in this make or break moment. And it's going to start with Judas. Look here in chapter 14, verse 43. It's the betrayal, and immediately that's following there what he's saying in the previous verses, that he's telling his disciples, get up, are you sleeping? Look, the people coming to get me, they're on their way. And it says immediately while he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Here comes this small army to take care of one guy. Here comes this army to take care of a guy who has never stirred up any kind of insurrection against the government. He certainly taught about upside down thinking and saying a kingdom of mine is very different than the kingdom of this world. But he's never led an upheaval. He's never sinned. Jesus hasn't sinned. He lived a sinless life. And here comes this army with swords and clubs. And you know beforehand that Judas had made an arrangement about how he's going to identify who they need to arrest, which tells you something about this crowd in this marked moment. that some of this crowd didn't really know who Jesus was. That Judas had to tell them, hey, I'm going to kiss this guy on the cheek. The one whom I kiss, that's who you need to seize. And so he comes in now on Gethsemane, and he does this here in 45. When he came in, he went up to him at once and said, Rabbi, and he kissed him. Very customary to kiss on the cheek, much like when you see maybe European relationships where people kiss each other on the cheek. It was normal, okay? So he says, Rabbi, probably puts his arms out, comes up to him and kisses Jesus. What's Jesus thinking right there? I mean, he had just told him at the meal before, hey, Judas, what you have to do, go do it. Leave. I mean, he knew about it. He's accepting this fake gift of a kiss from Judas. So he kisses him, and right after that, the intensity starts to skyrocket. I mean, you saw an inner intensity with Jesus in the garden where he's literally sweating blood. That's how emotionally tied up he is in life. Have you ever been there in those moments when you're just so consumed with something that you feel like you're going to burst? Well, all that internal intensity is now really going to go out, and it's going to start coming towards him. And you're going to see Jesus with laser-like focus. It says all the way back in chapter 12 that he set his face towards Jerusalem, that he knew what he had to do. He had a mission. He had a vision. Now he's out of those prayerful moments with the Father, and things turn up. Look at verse 45. Or verse 46, and they laid hands on him and seized him. That doesn't mean they just put their hands kindly on him, like, this way, sir, let's go. You know, as people shuffle you through the mall or a crowded street or whatever. This means they start to punch him and grab him. But there's people with him. There's disciples with him. But one of those who stood by, we know this to be Peter, verse 47, drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. God bless Peter. We're going to get back to him in a little bit. Man, he is a speak and act first, think later kind of guy. The sword is not what you think, like Dungeons and Dragons, big sword. It's probably a little personal-sized dagger that's on his hip. But he sees this happening in Jesus, and you know, Peter's just going to do it. He thinks, he's like, no! And he cuts off the ear of this soldier. From other gospels, we get clarity on who this was, what his name was, and that Jesus even says, Peter, put away your sword. That's not how this is going to work out, by the way, violence for violence. What I'm about is not going to go this way. In this Mark moment, Peter, would you put away your sword? It even says that he heals that guy's ear. Which, what's that guy thinking? These religious people got me up in the middle of the night to go get some dude. I was sleeping. He cut off my ear. And then he touched it and his back on. What's he thinking about this guy, Jesus? He's thinking, this guy's different. All right, does he step back away from the crowd as everybody's still grabbing and people are starting to run? And he's like, what just happened? Because I know my ear was cut and I was mad, and now it's not. And it's going to affect everybody, this intensity. Look at it. It continues to rise. And Jesus starts telling them, have you come out against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day, I was with you in the temple teaching. You didn't seize me, but let the scriptures be fulfilled in this. And they all left him and fled. That's his people, not the soldiers. Not the religious leaders who wanted to capture him, all his homies, the ones who were sleeping, fled, run away. We get a silly picture here in the next couple verses as a young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth. That's his jammies. That's his pajamas. He's up in the middle of the night. He's in his linen cloth. It says he has that on, and when they seized him or grabbed him, they grabbed hold of the linen, but he ran away naked. And you always wonder, why is something like that in your Bible? All it is telling you, look at the intensity. Whatever's going on here in the garden is causing people to run away in fear for their life. It's a serious, marked moment, and his disciples are scattering like mice in the cellar when you turn on the light. They're just fleeing. They're just running away. These guys who for 3 years had watched Jesus do everything that he did in ministry and probably had great faith in the moments of those times, are now running away. So if you've ever turned and run away at a marked moment, be encouraged, you're not alone. But Jesus is left here by himself, laser-like vision on what's next to come. And his disciples have left. And he starts this process in 53 and following that we usually skip. Most of the time we read in our devotional, reading Gethsemane, and we all feel good. All the harmonizers are like, I so identify with Jesus just pouring out his heart. This is great. And then we like to get to Golgotha, the place of the skull where Jesus is going to be crucified. But we miss what happens here. because it just feels like they shuffle them around in the middle of the night, and then you get to the crucifixion. We will get to the crucifixion. But you have to understand what happens here in the night, what happens with Peter, because a lot of questions are going to be asked of Jesus. A lot of evidences are going to be given of why those questions, what the answers are to those questions. And then people are going to respond. People are going to respond. Have you ever wondered what was it that got Jesus killed? We're going to learn that in our time. What was it really that got Jesus killed? What was surrounding it? What kind of questions were people asking? And you may even think, and I've seen, those questions are still asked today by people, if it's true about Jesus. And I could bore you. I got a really cool chart my friend Mike gave me that has all the times and when and where, and this was Jewish, and this was Roman, and this person, that person. That's not where I'm going with this, okay? We're not going to nerd out, even though Instagram said that this week. I want you to look at these people and see them for who they are. And in this marked moment of intensity, this pivotal point in history, listen to the questions they're asking, listen to the answers that are given, and identify where you fit in. Verse 53, they led Jesus to the high priest. They take him to the big boy, the leader of the Sanhedrin, and you know it is because of the next part, and all the chief priests, elders, and scribes came together. It's well documented at this time. There's 70 guys that rule Israel at this time, at least religiously. They're called the Sanhedrin, and he's taken right to the high priest's house, showing up in his courtyard, and they're going to deal with him. Why are they doing it at night? Because it's a huge festival and feast going on in Passover. And they want to act quickly, and they want to do this before actual Passover gets here. They want to have this problem of Jesus solved so they can get on with their religious duties. That's why they're doing it at night. The Jewish part is first. We'll get to the Roman civil and formal authority here in a little bit. Peter's along, verse 54. He's following at a distance, though. Somebody so close and such a fighter is now at a distance and now in the shadows. Now lurking around, probably still loving Jesus because he's there and wants to see what happens, but not having enough faith or courage to step out and identify himself. So he's in the shadows there and the high priest, and he's warming himself by the fire, probably because it's at night and it was cold. In 55, look at the questions that start to come, the intensity raising here. The chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. In Jewish culture, from Deuteronomy, it's very well noted that two or three witnesses is what you needed to bring testimony toward someone to get a verdict. It couldn't just be you and your ideas against your neighbor. You had to have other people share the exact same testimony and share it so that that person could be convicted of whatever crime or situation could be dealt with. And it says they couldn't do it. It's probably because they're all fired up. They finally have this guy, Jesus, who's been doing outrageous things to their religious system, who's been calling them to change their lives in such a way that they haven't changed for generations and generations and generations. And now, could you just imagine the scene? Everybody talking over one another, charges being thrown out, testimonies being thrown out one after another, but it says they couldn't agree. So they found none, for many bore false witness. So not only are they sharing ideas about Jesus, they're lying about it. They're making up things about Jesus to get him convicted. It's a hostile world there. And these are the religious people. These are the ones who had the best chance at seeing God for who he was and the promises he said that were to come. And they're lying about Jesus' life. See, you can't argue with Jesus' life. I've never met anybody, whether they're a believer or not, secular or religious, Jesus lover or Jesus hater religiously, salvation-wise, what they ask. Nobody ever argues about the good that he did. No one's like, I can't believe that guy. He really cared for people and helped people. Like, I've never heard that out of people's mouth. And his life was evidence. But here are these people trying to give lies and false testimonies. Verse 57, some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, we've heard him say, I'll destroy the temple. And they go on to try to make the actual temple where they worship the focus, because that would be blasphemous and against their religious code. Yet you've read the book, if you're familiar with your Bible. Jesus even said himself, I'm not talking about a physical temple. The temple I'm telling you that's going to be destroyed and raised up in 3 days is me, the person. And they still couldn't get it. But you get this middle of the night, heightened emotion, lots of things flying around. And the high priest has to stand up here, and he has to be a leader, and he has to find some way to formally charge this man, Jesus. Verse 60, the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" Great question. "These things that the people are saying, have you no testimony? Have you no rebuttal, Jesus?" Look at Jesus' response. It's confusing at first. But he remained silent and made no answer. What? Jesus, this is the time. I mean, we have the wonderful opportunity to sit in our position outside the scripture, and as we're reading it, like, talk to it. Like, no, Jesus, this is the time to tell him exactly, perfectly. Bring your angels, bring the show, bring the fireworks. Do it right here. They're asking it. And yet he remained silent. Why? Because Isaiah 53:7 was right. Like a lamb, he was led to the slaughter. On his way to the shearers, he made no account. He opened not his mouth. He's fulfilling prophecy by remaining silent. And there's a sense when you know what to be true, when you know your life and your actions are totally approved by what God has to say, when people raise those lies, you don't have to say anything because you can just say, look at my life, in a sense. And you don't even want to entertain those things because they're so ludicrous and so out of bounds. It frustrates the high priest. And he gets very, very specific. You want to know what killed Jesus? You're about to find the answer and the question that follows. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" What does that mean? Simply put, he asked him this question. Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we've been hoping for? Are you claiming to be that one which was promised all the way back in Genesis and seen through many shadows and many types of men? Are you that one that's going to come and save the people of God? That's the question the high priest asks. And of anybody with any training in any history, he should have known. And there's so much irony in these passages that happen that the people who should know don't. And the people who have no clue are starting to see it. And so he asks, "Are you the Messiah?" Jesus opens his mouth now. For many times in this gospel, you saw him do things in Mark. He'll do things and then he'll say something weird. He'll be like, "Shh, don't tell anyone." He'll do some miracle and he'll be like, "Go home and show yourself," or "Go show yourself the high priest, but on your way, don't tell anybody. Go home, but don't tell anybody. Leave this town, but don't tell anybody." It's like he was secret along the way and he was timed. It's called the messianic secret in different commentaries of like, why is he doing that? Not anymore. Not anymore. There's no agony here. There's no sweating blood. The question is out. The intensity's up. He's already been beaten upon. He's already been spat upon. And the question comes to him now, are you the Messiah? Which is a question that really all of us have to believe in, one way or the other. Are you who you say you are, Jesus? Are you really the one, Jesus? Or is it just kind of all roads really are going to lead to the same place? Regardless that they compete and they have self-contradicting arguments, and even Jesus himself said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me." You think the answer that follows this question is important? You better believe it, and it's what got him killed. It's what got him killed. Look at his answer in verse 62. Jesus said, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." It wasn't even a simple yes. That started it. Then he hits them right in their back pocket, right in the knowledge that they would have. He quotes from Psalm 110 and Daniel 7 and says, "Yes, and you're going to see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of God, and you're going to see me coming in the clouds of heaven." He takes the whole Old Testament and he affirms it all about what it says to the Messiah, and he says, "I'm that guy. That's who I am." You see, the religious people missed it. They wanted him to be something else. Religious people often do. Their zeal is good, but if their theology isn't correct and they don't have the humility to see God for who he is, their religiosity becomes the focus. And they didn't like what Jesus was asking of their religious system. They didn't like his upside-down thinking that you can see clearly through Matthew 5 through 7, the greatest sermon ever given, when he turns all the ideas of that day on its head and it says, you know what? The meek shall inherit the earth, not the strong. Those low in spirit, those who are spiritually bankrupt, they're the ones who are going to get and receive and have. You see, they didn't like the type of Messiah Jesus was. And they wanted to kill him. And now the intensity turns up even more. Look what in this make or break moment for the religious people, look how the high priest responds. He tore his garments. And we think that's weird. It is. But in that day, really, it originally started tearing your garments as a sign of grief. You lost a dad, you lost a mom, you lost a sibling, you lost a family member. You would show everybody you were in mourning and grief by tearing your clothes. And how ironic now that this pious, religious, proudful thing now becomes, the grieving thing becomes that pious thing. You know, where he's hyper-religious, like, I'm grieving, this is so bad. It's like, you're missing it. You're making a show even now in your response. Because you're missing Jesus for who he is. And so he does this. What's your decision? He asked this crowd. And they all condemned him as deserving death. The problem was the religious community could not invoke capital punishment. They could only recommend it and say, this guy violated our religious system. He deserves death. And then they'd have to hand him over to Rome. And we'll get to Rome in just a second. We'll get to that trial in the middle of the night with the Roman officials here in just a second. But in the meantime, Mark gives us a little picture of another guy and another example, Peter. Peter was below in the courtyard. One of the servant girls of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, you were with the Nazarene Jesus, and you're going to see this three times to fulfill what Jesus told him. But you're going to see three times people look at Peter and go, you're with him. You're one of them. I've seen you with him. And three times he's going to say things. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't even know him. I am not with him. And you see this denial of Peter towards Jesus, whom he loved. Which we all get really angry at Peter there until we put ourselves in the shoes of, have we ever denied Jesus? Have we ever been presented with a conversation where people ask us what we believe? Like, oh yeah, Jesus. You know, we kind of shy away or whatever. If you've been there, can I give you encouragement? I've read on in the Bible. I've seen what God did with Peter. It wasn't enough for Jesus to get arrested here for Peter. It's not even going to be enough for him to be crucified for Peter. Peter's going to have to wait and see the resurrected body of Jesus come, and everything changes at that point for Peter. Because of the cross and the resurrection, you see a Peter in Acts that is not this hiding, denying follower of Jesus. You see a guy who gets up and preaches the gospel with boldness. You see a guy become the leader of the Jerusalem church who starts mission trip after mission trip and moves the center of the church from Jerusalem to Antioch and then turns it over to this guy named Paul. I mean, you see his life radically changed. If you're in a moment, can I just be a pastor for a second? If you're in a moment where you're living in the denial of Jesus towards your spouse, towards your family members, towards whoever, can I just encourage you, remember the cross. Remember the resurrection that was proof that he could conquer sin and death, and know that God's not done with you yet. God's not done with you yet. Even in a make or break moment for Peter, he wasn't done with him. He wasn't done with Peter, and that should give us hope because we serve a gracious and a good God. What Peter deserved here? Peter probably deserved what you and I think all the time, but what God showed him over time was grace. So be encouraged by that. Now back to Jesus, back to that Roman trial, okay? The rooster crows twice, Peter weeps, and in chapter 15, verse 1, you start here. And soon it was morning. That's what happens when the rooster crows. Okay, it's the sun's coming up, and they're super annoying. We have like 12 of them by our house, and one of them starts going at 4 o'clock every day. I just want to shoot him and hide him and tell my neighbor I don't know what happened to him. Roosters are annoying, but it's signaling morning. They're trying to get this done before the day starts. The chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council, and they bound Jesus and led him away and delivered him over to Pilate. Who's Pilate? Pilate was the equivalent of a governor at this point. He was over all of Israel in the hierarchy of Roman officials, and he did not like Jewish people, and he was not a good dude. But why would he come to Jerusalem this time? Because it was Passover. And as we learned a few weeks ago, there's 2 to 3 million people in the city that could barely hold a million. And so he's coming to make sure things don't get out of control. And now the religious leaders know we're going to take him to the big boy, Jesus, and see if we can't get a sentence here, a charge, because we want him to have death. Will you guys give him what we want? And will you execute what we want? That's why Pilate's brought into this, and they bring him to Pilate. And Pilate asked him a question. But notice that it's different than what the religious people brought up. What did the religious people say? What did the high priest ask Jesus? The religious person said this to Jesus, "Are you the Messiah?" Right? That's the question he asked. Look how it's spun. Look how it's become different. Look how intentional the religious people use different words to present Jesus to this Roman secular guy so that it might frustrate him. Look at the question there. It's subtle. Are you the king of the Jews? Why would that be a problem? It'd be a problem because Rome doesn't like any other kings. This is the time of the Pax Romana going out, and it's not really peaceful. It's actually super barbaric that they would put their thumb on anybody and everybody and keep everybody down. You can believe what you want, just don't trump Caesar, because Caesar's the ultimate. Don't trump government, because government is the final authority. And so these religious people change the question. They say, he's claiming to be king of us. And in other gospels, we see him ask questions like, he's refusing to pay taxes to Caesar. Is that true? No. These slime balls are lying now. Because what did Jesus say about money? He said, give to Caesar what's Caesar's, but give to God what is God's. And they've turned this whole situation upside down, and they say, he asked them the question, are you the king of the Jews? He does give him an answer, but it's not what you think. It's indirect. He says this, you have said so. In a sense, he would say this, Pilate standing for Jesus going, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus going, I didn't say it, you did. It's not smirk, it's not sarcastic. Those are the words out of your mouth, that's what you're saying, because he knows he's innocent. He knows that the kingdom he's talking about is so much different than a ruling place over religious people so that they can be their own nation. It's a make or break moment here. And the secular world is asking a question, are you gonna trump our authority? Do you think that's a familiar argument as a Christian today? Do you hear anywhere in newspaper or media or magazines or television, are you greater than the government? Does your God claim to be greater than the president? Is there an authority that's higher than your governor, your mayor, your president, your councilman, your representative? Do you hear those kinds of arguments today? Do you think that's being received very well? It wasn't received well here. It's not received well today. History repeats itself. Solomon was right in Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new under the sun. These aren't new arguments that are fresh, and it's just time to get with the times. It's time to get with God. There's no right side of history. There's those who are with Jesus and those who aren't. And the question he asks is, are you the king of the Jews? He says, you said it. And the chief priests accused him of many more things. You see that intensity just growing. They're trying to throw thing after thing after thing to get this guy killed so that they don't have to deal with Jesus. And little did they know that that's the very thing Jesus is focused on. That the death they wanted so bad was in fact the thing Jesus knew he came and had to endure. Pilate began to ask him, have you no answer to make? See how many charges they bring against you? But Jesus made no further answer, so that Pilate was amazed. Why is he amazed? Because he doesn't appear to be guilty. His life and these crazy charges are enough to make him go, this guy's innocent. This guy's innocent. Yet they've changed it. The religious people said, are you the Messiah? And Jesus said, you better believe it. The secular world said, are you the ultimate authority? He said, you've said so. Why does he say it like that now? Is he just giving up? No. Remember, he's laser beam focused right here. He's laser beam focused on what he has to do and what he has to endure this very day. It's morning time. By 3 o'clock, he's going to be dead. On a cross in a barbaric way. And we are a church that always encourages you to invest and invite in those around you, in your family members, in your neighbors, in your coworkers, and in your friends. And we always say it's better to invite them to your table first before you invite them to a gathering. Though our hope would be they trust in Jesus and they get involved in a local church somewhere. There's lots of great churches in this city. Can I tell you something to encourage you for the week to come? My friend Mike is going to be back next week. And he's going to bring a message that is not PG. It's not friendly. It's not visually easy. It's going to be hard. It's going to be graphic. It's going to be about the crucifixion. And you need to invite someone to see it and hear it. You need to bring somebody to hear the good news, upside down thinking that in order to really live, you have to die. That's coming next week. It's what's going to be the Roman solution for his non-answer or his slightly affirmative answer here. Now, at the 15 verse 6, you start to see a picture that is fascinating, and it blew me away over the past few weeks. In verse 6, it says this, "Now, at the feast he used to release for them one prisoner for whom they asked." At this time of year, whether it was just a cultural thing in Jerusalem, a religious thing, at Passover, the crowd could ask for a prisoner, one who was guilty, to be released. They could also ask for someone who has yet to be charged to be acquitted. And Pilate, as a favor to the people, this time of year, this religious holiday, to earn some kind of political favor, I guess, would do that. He would grant clemency, if you will, to a prisoner. And it says at this time, it was customary to do that. And among them, the rebels in prison, verse 7, who had committed murder in the insurrection, there was a man called Barabbas. So Mark's setting up here that it's customary for the Roman governor to release a prisoner at this time. And he's defining for us who one of those prisoners is. His name is Barabbas. He led in the insurrection. Most likely this guy was a part of the Sicarii, the dagger men, the freedom fighters of Israel, the ones who really wanted to rebel against Rome, to remove that authority and to let Jewish people be in power. They just took it by force. And it says he was a certified murderer. He had killed someone and is in prison for that, punishable by death. What does Barabbas know at this point in his life? He wanted the best for his people. He got a super patriotic and an insurrection, and he killed somebody knowing that that deserved death. Now he's in prison, what? Waiting to die. Totally condemned, totally guilty, waiting to die. And Mark says, here's this guy, Barabbas. Verse 8, and the crowd came up and began to ask Pilate to do what he usually did for them. And he answers them, saying, do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews? I mean, there was a sense that he thought these religious people were doing it out of envy. And he didn't like the Jewish people. And so he's trying to make a case for them. He's like, just picture, get the picture starting to form. Pilate in front of the people here early in the morning, there's Barabbas, this freedom fighter, murderer, condemned to death, who had sinned fully, who deserves death. And then there's this guy who lived a pretty great life, whom the religious people said, he wants to be king of us. And so Pilate's going, do you want the king of the Jews? It gets better, though, when you understand more about this, okay? He perceived it was out of envy that the chief priests had delivered him up. So he thought these Jewish people just wanted to deliver him up. So he's really, in a sense, trying to free Jesus because he sees him to be innocent in some ways. But they stirred up the crowd to release for them Barabbas. So it's like they're going around, and they're like, save Barabbas. Say Barabbas, say we want Barabbas. And they're stirring up the crowd. They're stirring up the crowd to, because they get to pick which one he releases. Do you know what Barabbas' name means? Bar Abba, when you break it down. Son of the Father. And many original manuscripts say that it was Jesus called Barabbas. Now, imagine, if you will, that Pilate standing before these people in a religious high point, the most intense night of Jesus' life, emotion at an all-time high, crowd starting to stir up, and he asked the crowd this question, which Jesus do you want? Which son of the Father do you want? The one that's condemned, certified, payable by death, condemned one, or the so-called King of the Jews? Which Jesus do you want? And it says the crowd responds and says, give us Barabbas. And he's like, all right, well, what do you want me to do with Jesus? And they do the same stirring up and they say, crucify him, crucify him, crucify him. Roman's barbaric way of executing people. And so Jesus is sentenced to death by crucifixion. But the most fascinating thing about this text in this moment at this time in history is I think the first guy in history to understand that Jesus took his place was Barabbas. The first guy in history to understand I deserve death and somebody else is going to die was Barabbas. It's a great picture Mark paints for us, isn't it? question for you and me is the same question Pilate presented to the people. Which Jesus do you want? In your daily life? In your living out of what is to come? In your workplace? In your home? See, the answer to that question is not simple, like, what do you want to eat after this? The answer to that question has eternal consequences. Which Jesus do you want? Friends, the good news is seen no more simply. If you can understand that Barabbas deserved death and was sentenced to that, and that Jesus took his place, took that death in place of Barabbas, if you can understand that, you can understand the gospel. If you can believe in that, you can believe the gospel for what it's worth. And this guy who's now delivered, it's so amazing, he's going to become our deliverer. This guy whom they put in chains and beat his back, he's going to break the chains of sin and death. This guy that's going to die is going to bring life to everyone who believes by faith in the name of Jesus Christ. That's what happened the night before he was killed. That's what happened in his marked moment between Gethsemane and Golgotha. And the question remains that we'll respond to, which Jesus do you want? Father, these are profound experiences we see in the Bible. We're grateful for who Jesus is and what he went through. We're grateful for his faithfulness. We're grateful for the hope he had, the death he knew he needed to endure for us. He was motivated by love, God, and we understand that. So God, would you help us respond in this time? Would you help us see our place that we were Barabbas, that we deserve death and sin was the reason and our own efforts couldn't fix it. We need somebody to die a death that we were due ourselves, and Jesus did that. And would you let that truth permeate every area of our life here as we sing and pray. Father, we give you this time. We look to your Son, Christ. Amen.